crying for support. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye, and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we spoke a fortnight ago?
Yeah, well, from a Spurs point of view, Dan, not too well, to be honest. You know, things not really panning out as we were hoping after the start. But, you know, football, it's good to have football back. And the games are coming thick and fast now with the League Cup this week as well. So looking forward for another interesting week of Premier League chat with you, mate.
Well, thankfully, it's not a Spurs-only podcast. It would be quite a dull affair. But thankfully also, we've got a bit of squad rotation this week because we're a bit light on numbers. But Paul McGarrickey, our super sub, is back in the fold this week. Paul, it's always a pleasure to have you on board. How have you been keeping since we last spoke?
Hi, Dan. Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure as always to speak with you. I've been doing good in the interim.
Fantastic. Right, so before we do all the social media bits and everything else, I need to thank Matthew and Max for their work as always. They're off scouting for me. I'm keeping them busy. They should be back in the fold next week. Those social media bits are, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at Real Football Pod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account for that. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. I also need to mention my content partner, that being betting.com for all the betting tips and predictions across the week. Go to that website, and the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast, put a dot between the R and the E, and you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. Where should we go first? Let's go to the Etihad, as although Man City were held to a 0-0 draw, and we don't really give 0-0 draws much credence on the show because there's usually something else to talk about, but we want to talk about their support this week. And Carl, for starters, from an outsider point looking in, do you think Pep's comments helped before the weekend's events?
Probably didn't help, you know, and I think obviously, you know, the discussions and the way that he was kind of talking about the fan representative probably didn't hold him in that good a light, to be honest. You know, it wasn't great, I don't think. But you kind of got what he was, you know, what he was trying to get at, wasn't he? You know, it was a bit like that kind of rousing, you know, come on, I want to get something, almost, you know, a small step away from the kind of Delia at Norwich, wasn't it? You know, let's be having you, where are you? So I could see what he was trying to do. Obviously, nowadays, that kind of thing backfires, doesn't it, massively? Because I think, you know, it's not the first time that people have questioned the sort of attendance at the Etihad and the fact of why they're not filling that ground. And, you know, who knows why, you know, I think it's a little mixture, isn't it? It is hard, you know, for the average working person. You know, you've got lots of football matches to try and pay for. I do know now that, you know, lots of season tickets don't cover cup football anymore. You know, when I had a season ticket at Spurs, my ticket covered all home cup matches. And that's not the case now. You know, those are extra add-ons that you have to go and buy. So I think, you know, there is a case to say that, you know, for the average fan, sometimes it is hard to constantly keep going and paying to go and watch these sort of football matches, especially when they're going to be live on telly. Maybe that's a contributing factor. It certainly won't be because the fans are not seeing the sort of football they want to see, because, you know, the one thing you are guaranteed when you go and watch Man City is you will see top quality football. So it will be interesting to know why sometimes they struggle to get the bums on seats there. You know, Main Road was always packed and was, you know, always a great place for atmosphere to go to. We've had many a great battle there between us and them. So, yeah, this is a real strange one. I don't think it helped when Pep came out and said that after the game, but I can see what he was trying to get at. He just wanted to make sure that the atmosphere on Saturday was there. It probably does give the players a lift, and he knew it was going to be a tough game.
Now, Paul, obviously you're a big City fan and the insider in all of this, so do City need to be worrying about fans through the door? Not from a revenue point of view as such, because obviously revenue's not really the issue up in the blue half of Manchester, but when you think about it, would you rather an organic fan base in the sense that your fans are your Man City fans rather than that lot down your road mopping up all the day drippers and such? So what's your take as a supporter of the club?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm one of the what the Super League clubs would call a legacy fan. You know, I was brought up in the days where we were in the third division and we had brother on our shirts and stuff like that, and you know, my first game was 1995, so I can remember going to Main Road and it being, you know, 30,000 when we're watching what was really atrocious football by today's standards. And but the atmosphere was always good. Now, the stadium bit is another argument, you know, the design and everything. We're talking purely about crowds. And for me, I recognise a lot of the people when I go to the games that I've been going for years. It's the same, you know, if you go on an away trip, you can go in one pub and you see all the same faces. It's usually the same core following. And I like that. It's the same with a home game. Obviously, there's more blues there. Typically, we are actually averaging one of the, you know, the more consistent attendances. But people like to pick out the number of blue seats that you get to see at the Etihad. I like the fact that our following has always sort of remained, you know, true. There have been games like in the Champions League, say a few years ago when we played, before the pandemic hit, we had a home game. I think it was against one of the German sides in the knockout stages of the Champions League. And the stadium was full of people on iPads, you know, that weren't really City fans. It was day trippers and the atmosphere wasn't nearly as good. So for me, I prefer a more dyed-in-the-wool local support, whether that means that we only get 30,000 or we only get 40,000. I don't really care. I like the fact that we're seeing football beyond what I could have ever have dreamed of as a kid growing up, seeing the likes of, you know, I mean, King Kladze was a standout, but then seeing Sean Goater and Paul Dickhoff, who are legends in their own right, but let's be honest, we're never nearly as talented as what these boys are now. You know, for me, I couldn't really care too much about the empty seat jibes, but I see how the news travels, particularly with social media, you know, and I think that's what's happened here is that Kevin Parker, who's the chairman of the official supporters club, he's reacted to other fans, you know, these football banter pages on social media. He's reacted to that. He's come out and had a go at Pep, completely misinterpreting the point that Guardiola was making, which was not just people turn up, it's turn up and bring an atmosphere with you. And I think it's sort of all been blown out of proportion in this case.
Well, Carl, if you look at City's vouchers that were on offer for the Leipzig game, it's not a great optic, but they're not the only club that's been, I don't know if guilty is the word, but they've gone down this route for late attendance. You look at Chelsea, there was always adverts on Talk Sport a day before the game. Come to Stamford Bridge, tickets only £35 and so. It's just the group stage of the Champions League is not as attractive for supporters, is it? When you sort of factor in, as you said, these additional costs early in the season where football does come quite thick and fast. It's almost a game, you know, Saturday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday and so on and so forth. There's not really that much money at the start of the season. So it's not just City which feel the pinch here.
No, they don't, do they? You know, and I remember the old, you know, it used to be Sunday you'd hear a school were in, weren't they, at matches, and you'd lots of school kids, and you knew that the club were obviously struggling to shift tickets, so they've invited some of the local schools along. As you say, Dan, I think, you know, one of the things we have to remember as well is the situation that the world is in. You know, we've just come out or are coming out of a global pandemic. So lots of people have had hard times. You know, money's not there as freely. Like, as we say, you know, there's so many factors. You know, subscriptions for your sports channels have gone up. You know, football clubs are asking parents to pay £100+ for a kit for their little ones. There's all these extras now that supporters are constantly getting pumped for. And, you know, another subscription to watch football on this channel, a subscription to watch football on that channel. Oh, by the way, kits are this much now. You know, merchandise is here, this, that. it's a lot to ask fans to constantly keep dipping their hands in their pockets, especially when we're coming out of the sort of current climate that we are. And as you said, Dan, unfortunately, it's great that we can see the amount of football we can see sometimes, but then there is that oversaturation, isn't there? And as you quite rightly said, you know, and we know all too well, don't we? Because we've been in the UEFA Cup group stages when you're playing like carrier bag and you sort of go, listen, you know, some of these games are pointless and it's not attractive to come and watch that sort of game. And there's too many of them. So you rightly say, you know, obviously, you know, the Champions League, if you're a club that's not in it season after season, then you're going to be at every game and you're going to fill that ground because it's a novelty factor and fans want to go and be part of that. But if you're looking at those clubs at the moment, like Man City, that they you're in it every season, there is the tendency where, you know, these sort of fixtures do become the norm. And once a fixture like some fixtures like those become the norm, it does wear thin a little bit. You know, I'm sure once they're in through the group stages and into the knockout rounds and they suddenly get Barcelona or Real Madrid at home, the Etihad will be packed and on fire again. It's just as we say, you know, I think the average supporter is being asked a lot to constantly keep putting their hand in their pocket for everything they need to watch football. And, you know, we are going to see a knock-on effect to that. And that will affect some attendances in midweek games. You know, forget people who have to work as well, you know, and they might not be able to get home from work. And some people might have kids, but they can't take their kids because the game's going to finish too late. So there's so many factors that go in. But as you rightly said, Man City are not the only team that will suffer from that. You know, White Hart Lane for the Europa Conference League games will have a lot of empty seats for some of those group stages. That won't always be packed out. As you said, quite rightly, you know, I remember coming home from work and, you know, the free paper on the tube on the Tuesday would have, you know, Chelsea, a big advert, come and watch the game, you know, cheap tickets. So they're not the only team that will suffer and they won't be the only team that ever will. You know, it'll always continue.
Paul, I think with the Leipzig ads that we saw last week, it's obviously easy to bash City, as we kind of alluded to. And again, it's a case of poking fun and whether you take the bait or not is up to you. But I think a lot of people forget there's still a great deal of anti-UEFA sentiment with the Etihad fan base, isn't there? That they're not really in a rush to give money indirectly to UEFA for European matches. So that's also part of the reason why fans decide to stay away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, both of you have made brilliant points there. And one thing I would add just to what Carl said as well, don't forget, without sounding political, there is a north-south divide in this country.
Yep.
And the working-class fan base around Manchester, you know, we are an East Manchester football club or a North East Manchester football club where it's not Leafy, Cheshire, or Altrincham or Alderley Edge. Our fan base is traditionally working-class. And that is reflected in the money that we have at our disposal and also the attitude that we take from or towards UEFA in particular, who we've always, since, you know, 2010, regardless of what you think about City being owned by people from the Middle East, you know, City have been trying to knock on the door and get into the Champions League. And we've done it now for 10 straight years. And unfortunately, in that time, we've had so many different things thrown at us from UEFA on like silly little things like our club was fined 45 grand for being 20 seconds late coming back onto the pitch at half time whilst in the same game. It was against Porto. Their crowd was being racist to two of our players and they got fined 4 grand. How are we supposed to take that institution seriously? You know, and UEFA seem to treat the club and the fans in general, and it's not exclusive to City fans, but they do treat us as consumers and with, you know, contempt. I think that was shown as well with the, you know, the Champions League final being moved to Porto. I was fortunate enough, I managed to get a ticket and everything, but it was two English clubs. Why did that need to take place in a foreign country? We could have had it taken place at Wembley. It would have saved a lot of money and a lot of cost to fans, but the reason why it took place in Portugal was because UEFA were only looking after their delegates who were coming from various countries that just so happened to not be on the UK's green list. So UEFA have made fans not even secondary, you know, the fans are a tertiary factor to the TV companies and their own, you know, delegates. So it's no wonder really that a working class club or its fan base as such feels like outcasts and unwanted towards UEFA and is reluctant to get as enthusiastic about its competitions.
Well, let's move on to the football itself, Cole. A 0-0 draw at home to Southampton. That's a coupon buster in anyone's book, really. No disrespect to Southampton, but at home, City should be winning that. How much should we be reading into this as a result? Is that the kind of result which makes Pep think, oh, if I now got that centre-forward over the summer?
No, I think, you know, obviously anytime City maybe draw and don't score, there'll be that kind of thing, you know, obviously with the Harry Kane's and Army, if they'd had Harry Kane, would that have been different? But I just think you just look at this game as a one-off. You know, Pep wasn't happy with the way City played, wasn't he? You know, yeah, he called a few players out, if you like, saying they just weren't playing the way he wanted them to and that, you know, they'll just have to practice. But they still dominated that game possession-wise. And it's just the case they've met a stubborn side that they actually on the day couldn't break down. You know, I do believe a world-class striker will help them. When that's going to happen for them, I don't know. You know, is that either going to, you know, would that happen in January or will they have to wait till next summer? I probably think they're going to have to wait till next summer. And unfortunately, I guess the one thing it could kind of hold them back slightly is those games where that one player can make a difference. You know, I've always said, and like Dan, that for me, I don't think Jesus is the kind of answer there on a regular basis. He can dip in and out of form, but sometimes you need a consistent player there scoring goals. I don't think Pep will be too alarmed, you know. I think when you look at the goals they're scoring after that, I think you just have to put this down as one of those frustrating days at home where they probably didn't play as well as they could do and just weren't able to kind of find the key to unlock the door. But I wouldn't be too worried, to be honest. I think if you're a City fan, you can be confident that with the talent you've got most weeks, you'll go into the game favourites and there won't be many sides that manage to keep you out at all. But for Southampton, that's a great point.
Well, let's ask the City fan, how confident are you across the season? Do you feel you have all the personnel in place? There's talk of a January move for somebody, but as we already know, it's really hard to get a big money move in January for the kind of player that City would need in terms of a Aguero replacement. So is this it for the campaign ahead?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, we have our obvious glaring issue of not having a consistent and outright number nine. Like Carl said, I'm not convinced that Jesus is really the long-term solution to that either. So somebody does need to come in. It will likely be next summer. I can't see anything from the people I know employed by the club. I can't see anything happening in January. However, we have just brought in a Brazilian striker called, I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's spelled Kaki, K-A-K-Y, who's 18. So he's obviously at the similar age and bracket that we brought in Gabriel Jesus in the January of 2016, 2017. Whether or not you'll get much game time, I don't know. He's only been in Manchester about 2 weeks and, you know, he's training with the first team. But obviously it's a new country and new league. So we might see him towards the end of the campaign. But other than that, yeah, it'll be the squad as is with Ferran Torres, Raheem Sterling and Gabriel Jesus sort of rotating in and out of that fluid front three. But credit to Southampton, they were able to weather everything we had at the weekend, regardless of which one of the three was in that position. And unfortunately, it's something that a lot of teams will look at because we don't have an alternative plan to one of, you know, those three options really at the moment, whether it's a false nine or, we're pulling in two forwards. It's kind of limited options, but, you know, we've got that much quality in midfield that it shouldn't be an issue.
I'll stay with you, Paul, because you mentioned Ferran Torres. Could this be the breakout season for him? Like, he always looks handy, but maybe there's a run of games that's really needed for him to be sort of that next bracket of player. So can he be, I don't know what his best position would be. I know you mentioned the fluid front three, so it's hard to sort of pin him down to one position, but can he make a sort of eventual land grab like Riyad Mahrez did? Didn't quite get off to the quickest start, but now he's a main feature of Pep's starting 11. So is Torres going to go the same way eventually?
I really hope so. And I think he's got every sort of physical attribute that you need. He's not the most, you know, tallest of strikers, but he's got a good leap on him. We saw that at Newcastle away last season where he got his first hat-trick. So he's one of those players. I think he's more of a confidence player. And if he gets given the right run, then he's definitely got everything. The makings are there for him to really push on, and I hope he gets given the opportunity. I liked him when I was at Valencia. You know, you may know I cover Spanish football quite a lot. And he is a player that was highly thought of there, and it really impressed me. So when he came to City, I couldn't wait to see what he could offer. But obviously, he's playing more centrally now, whereas in Spain, he was on the wing. But he's doing it for club and for national team, as we saw in the Euro. So I really do hope he can push on this season.
Well, Carl, the biggest flashpoint of the game was Carl Walker's red card, which was then quickly rescinded. So what did you make of that?
Yeah, I felt we came to the right decision, to be honest, in the end. You know, you look at it, it's one of these, isn't it? For the referee in real time, it's one of them that's hard to kind of, you know, that split second to make that decision. But thankfully, you know, you've got VAR there. And for me, I think the right decision was made. And that just kind of shows you when VAR's working well, that it's great to have there. It's the sort of tackle that Carl Walker's kind of been famous for, isn't it? And Roy Keane has kind of lambasted him for that, kind of throwing himself in the box where it's a bit touch and go. But I think ultimately the right decision was got to there.
Well, Carl, stay with you, because week 5 of the Premier League season is in the history books for this season. Is there a sense that the cream has already risen to the top, and that cream involves Chelsea? Would you say after Sunday's showing against our lot, they're looking like the real deal this time around?
Yeah, I think so. You know, they were looking really good once Tuchel came in last season, weren't they? You know, and you kind of thought he'd got them playing really well. You know, they finished the season strong by winning the Champions League. And, you know, in that game, it looked like they'd kind of had City's number and looked a really good side. And I think then when you then go and add a striker like Lukaku, who now seems to be in full flow and has really kind of developed into the player people thought he would be, then they are looking very formidable at the moment. You know, great defensively, plenty of attacking options going forward. Players like Kai Havertz have settled in now and really contributing. You know, if Tuchel can suddenly get something out of Werner this season with Lukaku, you got Mount, you got Kante. They are a real solid side. And, you know, I think we saw at the weekend, if you finish above Chelsea this season, there's a good chance you'll be champions.
Well, Paul, you would have seen Chelsea get the better of City just a few months ago. Apologies for bringing that back up. But tournament football's different. It's a short run of games. Anything can happen in 90 minutes. It's what you do over 38 games across 9 months. So try and be as honest as possible here. But where do you see Chelsea being stronger in terms of their squad versus yours at the moment?
Yeah, do you know, I think everything that Tuchel's done since he came in has been phenomenal. The turnaround, considering how feeble they look, particularly in defence, in my opinion, under Frank Lampard, and how well organised now they are, I think is incredible. Personally, I think they are the team to beat this season. I know fellow City fans might be upset with that, and certainly a few Liverpool fans and maybe even some optimistic United fans might feel the same way. But for me, yeah, Chelsea are the ones to beat, and I think the reason why is it's not so much all of the defence, it's the system that they have in place that links the midfield to that. Well, it's a back three that they play with, really, rather than a back four, isn't it? They just look so physically strong, but also have players who can read the game so well. You know, Rudiger is, the last 18 months, he's come on leaps and bounds. And I think that's where you start, really, isn't it? Your base is your defence, how well you can protect your goal, and then it's build from the back and work your way forward in the modern game. And I think that's where they perhaps have the edge over us, Manchester City. You know, it's a well-known fact we don't have a good left-back. Our best left-back is our right-back, João Cancelo. So, defence is a bit where they edge it, and I think that's the basis of which allows their midfield, and they've got a fluid front three or front two, I suppose, that really allows them to kick on.
Well, they've really got a squad, haven't they? I mean, Kovacic has kicked on another level this season. Kante comes off the bench, scores on Sunday. Timo Werner, really, if we're being hypercritical, was a flop. Now, most teams would go, we'll give him another season. Not Chelsea. We'll go and spend 100 million and get Romelu Lukaku. That really difference, Carl, I guess, is the kind of the winning ambition of Roman Abramovich, that I know it's a spending money, but really that's his right. And as long as it's within the flimsy framework of FFP, it doesn't really matter, does it? And that's what keeps them up at the top.
Yeah, that's right. And it's what they've always done, isn't it? You know, Lampard came in and he was prepared to give him a season when they had the difficulty with signing players they did, and they had a good start. But the one thing you can't knock Chelsea for and Abramovich for is once he sees something isn't working and he doesn't think it's going to happen for him, he doesn't just sit there, you know, sit on his hands and think, well, let's just ride this and see how it goes. He's brave enough to go and make a decision and change it. And like you say, he did that with the manager and look how that's paid off. You know, there'll be lots of clubs sitting there going, oh, you know, why didn't we do that earlier? You know, maybe we should have made the move. He did it, as you say. Werner, you know, I thought that was a great signing for them when he got him, but he's missing sitters that, you know, there are sort of under nine players who'd finish some of those off. And as you say, he hasn't just sat there and gone, well, let's just give him another season and see if it can change. No, I want to win things. And if I want to win things, I need a top class striker in my side. Who's out there? Lukaku? Yeah, you'll do. Come, 100 million. There you go. As you say, Dan, you know, you can't knock the guy for doing what he's doing because ultimately, you know, what he's done and how he's working works. You know, if he gets rid of managers, they go and win a trophy, you know, and he brings players in, as you say, whether people sit and go, yeah, it's always, you know, it's done by spending money. Well, you know, yes, but in football, that unfortunately is how it works, isn't it? If you want to be the best, you've got to go and match the best and the best spend big money and bring the best players in. You can't knock Abramovich for doing that. And lots of people don't like the method and don't like the way they run their football club. But I'll tell you what, it's been successful. And I'd have swapped some of what, you know, I'd have happily snapped someone's arm off for some of what they've had over the last 10 or so years.
Well, Paul, with the turnover of managers, these new men have new ideas. And also, as we've alluded to, Roman's not afraid to spend a pretty penny or two. But that does mean that players quickly get forgotten. One of those, Ross Barkley, he's in the Chelsea wilderness. What happens to him?
Yeah, well, it's a strange one with him because, you know, I was kind of shocked that they went for him in the first place because I didn't really think he was, one, the player that they needed, and two, really, of the quality that they already had. But he had a good run. And it was it last season he was, or the back end of last season, or the season before, he was ended up on loan at Aston Villa, didn't he? And he's fallen off the radar. His stock has fallen a long way. I don't know where you do go apart from drop down and try and work your way back up. But he is, like you say, he's a forgotten man.
Well, whether a Premier League player of his ilk is prepared to drop down a division just to get minutes, it's hard to say, really. Whether he's just someone who wants to collect a wage. I mean, you couldn't blame him if that's the case. But it does kind of show that when Chelsea have all this talent, there are going to be losers in all of that because you can't play everyone. And Ross Barkley is symptomatic of that. I mean, Carl, we were linked with Ross Barkley at one point, and hindsight's wonderful. Whether it would have ever worked out, you don't know. But we need some creativity in midfield because we talk about that cream at the top, and Tottenham are nowhere near. You know, we always talk about the big six. I think it's a top four and the rest this season. If Spurs really have any European hopes, it's either winning the Europa Conference League or somehow getting a top six finish, and the latter looks rather unlikely at the moment.
Yeah, it does. You know, I mean, you know, we do our pod, don't we, Dan? And there's an air at the moment of a bit of doom and gloom around based off of the last two performances. And I'm like you, you know, for me, I think this season, even top six is probably beyond us. You know, I'm looking at seventh or eighth because, you know, the teams that are up there right now, you know, Brighton are obviously the surprise package. They're doing really well. You've got Leicester. They're going to come on. You know, we know how good they are. Villa look, you know, reasonably good. And you've got West Ham that are there that have been so consistent and you know, are unfortunate this weekend as well. It's going to be a real battle. I think your top four or five are pretty much there, set in stone, who we know it's going to be. And then it's pretty much a bun fight after that. Unfortunately, I think if we look at our squad, I just think we're too thin to go over the course of the season in the league. And I'm like, you know, I agree with you. I think our best hope for some sort of success this season is by the cup competitions. You know, we've got the Europa Conference League and a lot of fans are turning their nose up at it, which I'm a little bit surprised at given our recent history in competitions. You know, I don't think we can afford to turn our noses up at that. And when you look at the sides that are in there, will you get a better opportunity to maybe win a European competition? Because, you know, the standard there are teams that we should really be beaten if we can put our best side out. You know, obviously, we all know that this is going to come down to a Jose Mourinho semi-final or final, and that's something you don't look forward to. But we've got a real chance in that. So for me, I think our season kind of rests on those competitions, because I just don't think the squad has got the depth or the quality over 38 games. To, they're definitely not going to push the top four at all. And I very much doubt they're going to push, you know, fifth or sixth. For me, it's a seven or eight season at best. And then, you know, we're back to where we're going to go from there. Lots of question marks over Nuno already. A couple more defeats, and I think the pressure really piles on for him as well. And, you know, it could all turn very ugly very quickly for this season for us. We've just got to hope we can find a bit of form, but we've got to really sharpen up defensively, and we've got to start looking like we're a dangerous team that can score goals, which at the moment we look a bit of a blunt knife.
Well, we look a blunt knife because of Harry Kane isn't sharp. So, Paul, as a City fan, are you looking at a man whose heart is elsewhere? If that is the case, does he run the risk of having a poor season to the point where Pep might think, do you know what, actually, it's not really worth the hassle next time around? Or does that work in his favour, because then it chops off 20, maybe even 50 million of his value, and he might just get him from 100 million instead?
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly knocked him. He doesn't look the same player to me. If I'm being honest with you, from a City point of view, I think this summer just gone was Kane's chance to move for us. I don't think we'll go back to him, because we don't want to have to deal with Daniel Levy. So if Kane's going to leave Tottenham, it won't be to City, in my opinion. I'd say the trouble looking at Spurs at the moment isn't just Harry Kane, though. You'll know better than me, but I don't actually know now. If it was like 12 months ago, I would be able to tell you, but at this point in time, I don't know what your best 11 is. I couldn't put it together. And I don't think that that's Bruno's fault. Nuno's fault. I think if you look at the difference between the style of play, he's trying to be more creative. But, it's not that he's missing something. I think it's just that it takes time. There's clearly a process that he wants to instill. It took him a while at Wolves. And since he's left, look, Bruno Lage's not having the best of shouts there. But So Nuno's a good manager that needs to be stuck with. I agree with what you were both saying, though, as well, about not turning your nose up at competitions. The Conference League, it's a new one, right? It's the lowest of the three in terms of people's point of view on the European Cups. But my club has won four out of the last, five League Cups. And we celebrate every single one like it's the first and last that we're ever going to win. It's not the highest priority in England. But it's a trophy, and you don't get that just by turning up. So I would say that the Europa Conference League this year is something that Spurs really, if you went all out for it, there's not really that many teams that I could honestly say, on paper at least, are nearly as good as the squad that Spurs have. So go for it. Just avoid the relegation in the Premier League and go all out to win the Conference League. It'll lift the mood around the camp. The last trophy you won was the League Cup as well, wasn't it? Was it Juan de Ramos?
Yeah.
2008?
Yeah.
And so just getting that winning feeling back, doesn't matter whether it's a League Cup, a Europa Conference League or what, that'll bring everybody together and it'll lift the mood. I just trust in Nuno, in my opinion. Trust him.
No, in our luck, we'll win the Europa Conference League and get relegated. But I move on, because we need to go across Manchester now, or at least down to East London, because Cole, United got out the capital by the skin of their teeth. And although David Moyes will publicly say he has no regrets in subbing Mark Noble on as an injury time penalty taker, surely he's going to be ruining such a decision behind closed doors.
Yeah, it's a real interesting one where you kind of wonder, don't you, whether it was, sentiment kind of ruled the head. And as everyone has discussed so far, when you've had a player that's not come on and not touched a ball or kicked a ball to then make their first action to be to take a penalty kick, I think there is an element of pressure that gets put on that player. And it's probably not the best way to be introduced to a game. We saw it in the summer, didn't we? And we've seen it again here. So I would imagine that there won't be many managers making that mistake after. I'm sure West Ham had better players on the pitch that could have taken that for them. It wasn't the best penalty. It was a good save. And yeah, West Ham then sit there and look back on that and think, you know, if only that, because that would have been a really good point for West Ham. You know, it's that next step for West Ham, isn't it, of getting results against those top sides that will help elevate them to the next level and possibly put them in a real push for top four. You know, it, while they keep losing to, say, the top four, it was the kind of thing that was happening to Tottenham all the time when you're trying to reach that next level. You know, you're okay against the best of the rest, but when the top four come, you can't get results. And I think when you start getting results against those sides, that really makes you, you know, it really elevates you and feel like, yeah, you know, we are ready to go on to the next level here. I think he'll be sitting there and, you know, if they're in a manager's meeting room at some point this week, they'll be going, yeah, we did make a boo-boo there. We're not going to do that again.
Well, Paul, I guess it's one of those decisions where if you get it right, you're labelled a genius. Let's take Louis van Gaal in the 2014 World Cup when he brought on Tim Krul for those penalties against Costa Rica. Everyone thought, oh, wow, that's Louis van Gaal. You know, he's just such a great level coach that that's what he does. However, on Sunday, we see that the gamble can also spectacularly backfire. And really, fundamentally, you've got to ask yourself, why bring on a player who is cold, not warmed up? Yes, it's, you know, a legend to the club, but you're not in the right frame of the game, are you? Surely you need someone who's just a bit more lively. So, you know, we know what went wrong. It's quite obvious, but surely that is a decision which is going to be rude for quite some time.
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, in David Moyes's, well, looking at his situation, you know, I think he's had to come back to West Ham and he's had to try and win over fans and build up a bit of capital with them because, you know, I'll be one of the first to talk my hands up when they announced he was returning. And one of his quotes in his press conference was, they're bringing me in because they want a coach that wins and that's what I do win. I thought, really? You know, so he's kind of undone a lot of goodwill that he might have built up over the last year or so. It's a strange one. The Van Gaal example is the first thing that came to mind, to be honest. Maybe he wanted a bit of leadership and Mark Noble, you know, he gives you 200%, doesn't he? He does wear his heart on his sleeve and goes for it. But yeah, it's tactically and managerially, it's very poor by David Moyes.
So, Carl, it was another good afternoon for Ronaldo as he continues his run of scoring in each Manchester United game since his second stint has started. And it already looks like he's going to pay off that transfer fee quite quickly.
Yeah, well, I mean, the transfer fee was nothing, is it? Because, you know, what Ronaldo brings you outside of football alone, it is worth more than the transfer fee. So, you know, Man United, they're already a global brand. But when you sign Cristiano Ronaldo, it takes you to the next level. And the money is nothing compared to what you'll earn from having him. But also what he does bring is he brings you quality. And we've seen already in his time there that, you know, he'll score goals for fun. He'll win you games by being that sort of special player. And he'll probably be a great influence in and around the squad. And, you know, if you see him walk through the door, then you would be sitting there going, wow, you know, this is great. Look who's just come in to come and play with us. And if you can feed off of him and learn off of him, then, you know, you would be thinking that it's great all round. I kind of felt for him this weekend because, you know, he had the couple of penalty shouts. And the first one, I think you could sit there and maybe go, yes, that one was touch and go. I felt the second one, to be honest, I wasn't sure how that wasn't given as a penalty because I think, you know, he gets the defender into the box, backs him off, pushes it past him and the defender makes a lunge. And for me, I thought the second one was a stonewall penalty. The first one, I'd say, you know, yes, does he go down a bit too easy? Who knows? But the second one, I felt he was unlucky. And then obviously, you know, he would have been able to get his name on the score sheet again. But there's no negatives in him being at Man United and there can only be positives. And, you know, you don't turn that sort of move down if it opens itself up to you.
Well, Paul, it was nearly a tale of two penalties right at the end of the game. So obviously we've just discussed the one that West Ham were given. But do you feel that Kurt Zouma took Ronaldo to the ground? Should that have been a penalty?
Yeah, so I think it could be given. I'm one of these people, maybe I'm seeing it through bitter blue tinted glasses and I don't really want to see Ronaldo get given anything. But I think he's also looking for it. I know it's a cynical thing to say, but I think, yeah, all right, there's probably more in favour of giving that one than against it, but I'm happy with the way that one turned out.
Well, Carl, of course, Martin Atkinson did give that penalty to West Ham eventually after a bit of a nudge from the man in the VAR tower. So what do you make of Luke Shaw's body shape? Now, it's not on purpose, is it, when you think about it? But when you have your arms like that, you're going to make the decision much easier than it should be.
Yeah, I think, you know, defenders have to learn how to defend, don't they, again, Dan? Because as you say, when your body shape is in that position, I think you bring in that element of doubt and you bring in VAR to look at it. And then it's all about interpretation, isn't it? You know, I'm sure we'll see some weeks where that's not given. And everyone will be going, well, hang on a minute, you gave one like this a few weeks ago. But yes, you know, it wasn't the best. It wasn't the best position. He gets himself a little bit caught out, and ultimately it results in being given as a penalty in the end. But that is something that defenders have just got to learn, a new art of defending, especially in and around the box. And, you know, the same with, you know, with the handballs. You know, defenders, we've seen a few defenders that now just go with their arms behind their back. We saw Ben Davies the other week put his arm out, and those sorts of things. Now you're asking for troubles because we've got VAR there to look at it. So defenders have to be really smart with how they're defending, especially in and around the box now.
Well, Paul, you could argue that Atkinson himself didn't have a great game because we're referencing Ronaldo penalty shouts and West Ham decisions. But I think really the big question is, how on earth did Aaron Wan-Bissaka not give away a penalty in the second half when he absolutely spleened Thomas Souček?
I don't know. It's hard to really sort of try and, you know, be diplomatic about it, I guess. The game does happen fast. You know, all the cliches that they say in favour of VAR and defensive referees now about it being it's at full speed. How can they be, expected to get everything right? But like we've just talked about how technology can help. Why is it not used, for other decisions and stuff? Consistency is a big part of it. There's certainly some revisions there that are needed.
Well, I was going to ask you about consistency in the next point, so I'll come back to you in a moment because, Carl, Max in our group chat almost demanded we speak about this because no one else has spoken about it. Simakassi's trip on Benteke as Liverpool got the better of Crystal Palace at Anfield, not even looked at, not even a talking point in terms of analysis or match day or anything. So how does that go under the radar?
Yeah, this one was really disappointing, wasn't it? And, you know, you can see from a Palace point of view why you'd be really upset, because I don't know how someone has managed to look at that again and not go, well, that's a penalty. You know, the guy has purposely brought him down with no intention of playing the ball in the box. And that is a penalty. Like as you say, I was actually shocked that you're watching, you know, when you watch on a match of the day, you're thinking, right, this is going to be a talking point of, you know, should Palace have had a penalty? Nothing, not even a mention. And for me, it was really poor. And, you know, if I was running those referees and over the thing, I'd be going in going, well, hang on a minute, guys, what happened here? You know, why have we looked at this and not given a penalty? And again, it just doesn't help that narrative, does it, around the top four or five getting those sorts of decisions that they shouldn't do and things being overlooked when it comes to them. Now, it may not have changed the game. Maybe it would have made the game 3-1. But it's not right. You know, Palace at that point had the chance to take the lead. And who knows where that game goes from there at that point if they go one up. Really bad decision. These are the sorts of things I'd like officials to come out and someone explain. Right, can you just explain when you've looked at this, why is that not a penalty? Because we've seen some really bizarre instances like this over the last couple of seasons. And it does make you angry. It does get you frustrated. And whether or not you'd agree with it, if someone was to come out and say, well, this is why we didn't think this was a penalty when we looked at it, although you still wouldn't be happy, you'd at least feel you've had an answer as to what was going on. But I think that was a shocking decision. And the fact that it was just kind of washed over by everybody, I felt that was even bizarre as well. So rightfully, if that had been in a Spurs game, I would have, you know, I'd have been tearing my hair out and rightfully felt very angry.
Well, Paul, you mentioned consistency, but I think the only consistent thing was two huge errors. You know, Wan-Bissaka and Tsimikas both avoiding any censure in terms of a penalty. So I know VAR is meant to be lighter touch this season, but to have no touch at all seems rather concerning, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that in itself is an inconsistency, isn't it? You know, it's supposed to be clear and obvious, and like you say, if you've only watched the Match of the Day coverage or you know, the highlights on Sky, and they've skirted over it, then you don't get the full picture. But watching it as a full game and seeing something like that, you think, how is that not being reviewed? And so the application of VAR is something that does need to be worked on. Like Carl said, you know, it might have only made it 3-1, but these games, if you think like in Rocky when the Russian is cut, you know, I'm not saying that that's a Crystal Palace thing, but cast your mind back to 2013-14 and Liverpool had a commanding lead over Crystal Palace and the game ended up in a draw, didn't it? And Suarez and Gerrard were crying. And I'm not saying that that would happen at Anfield when, you know, from 3-0 down, but these little tiny things do have a greater impact on the game, and it might influence other decisions, or next weekend there could be something similar where we do see an intervention from VAR, and you know, that's not what we want. We want the consistency so that we can at the end of the season go, yeah, it's a fair finish, it's a fair standings. And if it was like that, if it was applied consistently, you wouldn't mind if it goes against your team.
So going to the blue half of the Merseyside now. And Carl, on last week's show, we spoke about Everton. Because they were in the top four, we have to legally ask the question, can Everton finish in the top four? And after their result against Aston Villa on Saturday, you'd have to say no.
Yeah, the same failings are there, aren't they, with Everton? You know, no matter what manager they bring in, you know, they'll have results that make you think, oh, right, you know, Everton are looking really good. And then they go and have results like this at the weekend where they're suddenly outplayed and, you know, lose really badly. And you just start to think, well, hang on, you know, what's going on here? That was a bad defeat this weekend for them. You know, they've looked reasonably decent this season. You know, had a good win against Burnley last time out. And you're thinking, right, yeah, you know, go to Villa and kind of set down a marker to say where you are, and they just can't do it. And I think, you know, Everton get caught in this sort of cycle, what seems to be every season, you know, where when those big games come round where they need to put down a marker and show everyone, listen, we mean business this season, they end up going and letting themselves down. Again, I don't think they've brought the players in that get them into that top four, unfortunately. I think they're in a fight for fifth or sixth, even maybe seventh, because they just don't seem to be able to get that consistency together. It's early in Rafa's tenure, so we need to see how he goes, and, you know, a couple more months in, we'll really know what they're all about. But that was a defeat that I think, like as you say, Dan, kind of lets you know that I don't think they've got enough about them to really put that top four under pressure at all.
Paul, they literally collapsed after Matty Cash's stunner. So how of a concern will that be to Rafa Benitez? Three quick fire goals conceded. Not really what you want on your charge sheet, is it?
No, not at all. And particularly for the second one was the corner, wasn't it? The own goal.
Yeah.
You know, the defending there was atrocious. It wasn't much better for either two goals, but in terms of that one, that's one that Benitez in particular, because he's such a tactical manager. If you've ever like read Craig Bellamy's autobiography, and he talks about how Benitez is actually a really difficult manager to play with if you've not got the tactical acumen that he requires, particularly in defence, then it can be, you know, really a long season for you. And I think looking at that Everton team, there are players in the defence that don't have, you know, the acumen that's required, and they will struggle until he's able to get people buying into his philosophy and understand his way of defending. And like I said, you know, Chelsea's strength earlier was that the organisation they have between the defence and the midfield, and that allows them to build further up. Everton don't have that at all this season. And I'm not convinced that the squad is as good as some people might say it is.
Well, as I said, Matty Cash scored a stunner, and Brighton are stunning everyone because they are far too high in the table compared to last season. Everyone's talking about XG last year. They're getting points this time around. Carl, I know you're a huge fan of Graham Potter, and I don't know about you, but every win the Seagulls rack up, you get the feeling that he's the one that got away for Spurs.
Yeah, I've made no secret, Danov and I, that, when obviously, there was talk of Conte, before Conte, I wanted Potter based off of the football that I see Brighton playing, because I think they just play some really attractive football. So Potter was someone high on my list of managers I'd like to have seen come in. Then you get Potter, then you get Conte talked about, and you think, well, yes, okay, listen, if it's Conte or Potter, I'm going for Conte. After that, I would have gone back to Potter. He has got Brighton playing some really good football. Yes, the chances are they're not going to be able to sustain the push and keep where they are over the course of a season, given the squad depth and strength they might have. But you've got to give them credit for where they are and the way they play the game. And that's something that, I think for me, if Nuno doesn't see the season out, he's the man I'd turn to. I think, you hear really good things about him, and you've just got to see it in the way that the players play for him. So I'm really impressed with Brighton. Like I say, they won't be able to keep this up, I don't think. They will have those bad performances every now and again. But if you're a Brighton fan, you're going to be really pleased with the way things have started this season. And if you can keep Potter, I think you'd be really excited about the future you've got. And, it looks like as well, they've also kind of got themselves a real steal in Mark Carella that they've brought in for 15 million from Getafe last season. He is looking a really good player, and one that I think will help push Brighton on this season.
Paul, what have you made of Leicester this season? They were unlucky in terms of offside decisions on Sunday, but only 2 wins from 5. It's not quite going their way at the start of the campaign, is it?
No, it's not quite, and I think they set quite a high bar in terms of style as well as substance last season. So it's going to be difficult for them to follow. But I think for me, when I'm watching them, I don't see it as being a case of them lacking either quality or the personality. I just think it kind of just looks a little, ring rust is the wrong way to go about it, considering we're a month in the season now. But I think it's just that they're having a bit of a slow start, and Brendan Rodgers is the sort of manager that can quickly, or usually quite quickly, he can address problems that arise. And I think that they'll still have a good campaign, but it's not anywhere near the start that they would have hoped for.
Carl, it certainly went Watford's way on Saturday. They got the better of Norwich. Once again, Ismail Sarr showed that he's always ready to cause problems for any defence that stands in his way.
Yeah, he is, isn't he? And, unfortunately for Watford, you kind of sit there and say you better make the most of him this season and hope that he does enough to keep you up, because the way that he started the season, you certainly don't see him being at Watford the following season. But he's a real player, and he'll be one of the main people they'll need to rely on to keep them up. That was a good result, because that's the sort of team that if you're Watford, you definitely need to be beating those sorts of sides this season if you want to stand a chance of staying up away from home. Really good performance. And unfortunately, Dave, if you're Norwich, I think you just need to try and enjoy the ride as much as you can this season, because I think they're going to be the kind of whipping boys this year, and they'll be probably already, I would say that unfortunately you're going to need to prepare for another season back in the Championship after this one. But good result for Watford.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting with Norwich. If they are going to be the basement club, does the chairman give Daniel Farke the whole season? Because if he does, that's two failures. Yes, they are the perennial yo-yo club, but you can't keep going up and down. Yes,
I
it kind
think
of.
as well, Dan, isn't it? You'd want to see some form of improvement on your last
Yeah.
tenure in the Premier League. And like as you say, the way Norwich have started, it's not looking great for them. You get the feeling most weeks could turn really ugly. And as you say, if you're not going to see an improvement from where you were last time you were in that league, it's all well and good knowing you can come up from the Championship. That's great. But then ultimately, the idea is to stay in the Premier League. And you would start to sit there and think, well, if you've had a season and a half in this league now and we're getting battered most weeks, maybe you're not the man for that division. And I need to look at some options and get a manager in who might be able to get more when we do get up there.
Well, Paul, they came up with Brentford in the summer, and they are giving themselves a very good account of the Premier League thus far. They won at Molineux on Saturday, getting the better of Wolves, even with 10 men finishing the game. With that, they gave plenty of grit and determination. They didn't stop running. They were just workhorses to a man. One of those men was Ivan Toney, and he already looks like someone who can be the real deal at this level.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you what, they're an interesting side to watch as well. Like you say, they don't stop running, but they've just got a bit of a swagger about them as well. And I thought they really made this Wolves team look a little bit naive, from being honest. If you didn't know either side, you would think that perhaps Wolves were the newly promoted team and Brentford were the veteran Premier League team. Obviously, the game could have gone a bit differently if Adama Traore's shot hadn't hit the crossbar. But Toney, for me, he stole the show. And he proved that he was full of goals in the Championship. And it's great to see him doing it in the Premier League.
Now, Carl, Arsenal, they're slowly getting the house in order. 2 wins from 2. And that's going to provide some momentum going into Sunday's North London derby.
Yeah, it sets it up nicely, doesn't it, Dan? You know, hopefully they'll get a little bit too confident and hope that they're out of the woods and we might be able to take advantage of that. You know, it's two good results and two clean sheets that they'll take. I think the Burnley one, especially away from home, gives them some confidence because that is a notoriously tough place for them to go. You know, they struggled at home to Norwich, which they'd have been disappointed about. So I don't think Arsenal are out of the woods yet. You know, I think when they face, you know, a real tough challenge, I still think there's that element there where they can crumble. But you've got to start somewhere, so they'll be quite pleased too. And I think it's the clean sheets that will probably please them most, because that's where we think Arsenal have got a soft underbelly. It will now just be seen whether they can do that when they're put up against a little bit more firepower.
Well, Paul, as Carl says, they got the better of Burnley at the weekend. Sean Dyche has been given a new contract at Turf Moor, one that takes him to 2025 in theory. Now, he certainly deserves it, but it's been a very tough start to this Claret's campaign.
Yeah, it has, but I think he's had a similar start a couple of years ago, didn't he, where they were in the bottom three up until the week before Christmas, I think it was, and he managed to pull them out of the woods. And I think he'll do the same again because he's got a group of players that work for one another. They're not all, I mean, you know, some people call them identikit players, his midfield, because they're all, you know, usually typically British and more robust than they are technically gifted. But I think he's got a good spirit amongst them and they will start to get things right. And I think they're probably fortunate that there are teams in the division, or at least three of them, that are worse than they are, Norwich being one of them in particular.
Well, Carl, is Dyche's toughest job going to be creating the evolution of this squad? Because if you stay too long in the same group of players, you will stagnate. Even if you stand still, you will get left behind. So this current group, it looks not threadbare, but it's not as buoyant as other size squads in the Premier League. I know everyone registers 25, but there's 25 men and there's this 25 men you can really call upon. So that overhaul will take time. Do Burnley have time?
I guess, you know, it's the fact that there isn't the expectations for them to be knocking on the door of, you know, the top five or six gives him time. I think, like as you say, Dan, it is right that, you know, I think when you're a manager that stays somewhere as long as he is, you do need to move players on and get new players in, because it can't be long before players start to get a little bit tired of the tried and trusted methods and the training and, you know, the kind of that's get up and at 'em attitude. Excuse me. So I do think there is that element that he needs to kind of, you know, move players on and change that side around reasonably regularly so that he might be able to kind of get the best out of the players he's got in. And I think ultimately, if he's keeping Burnley in and around that, say, 9th or 10th, around that mark, it all depends on when the owners suddenly say, right, listen, we want more than that. But I see a struggle to see how Burnley's to start to get more out of there unless you're about to start having money to burn and go out and pay stupid salaries and stupid transfer fees. And I don't see Burnley being able to do that. So right now, maybe Dyche is probably the safest pair of hands they can be in.
Paul, finally, Friday night seems a long time ago, but Newcastle and Leeds are still looking for their first win of the season. And on the evidence of their showing at St James's Park, it kind of, that was the kind of idea you got from it, that these are two teams that aren't really overly confident in attack. Newcastle, very much less so. But of those two, who's going to be the most concerned?
Yeah, well, I mean, Leeds, I think, will probably be most worried in the short term. You know, they had 63% possession in that game and didn't do much with it. And they looked a little bit disjointed compared to last season. However, I would still be more worried if I was a Newcastle fan. You know, it's not even you can turn around and say that there's great football on show. With the exception of Sam Maximin, I don't really think there's too much to shout about. And it's a shame because I have a great affection for the people of Newcastle. They're always very nice to me on a night out and stuff like that. So it's a great little town to be, a great town to be welcomed into. But the football team, I think, is in a bad way at the moment. And I think if anything happens to Alan St. Maxim, then they're in big trouble.
Well, as someone who's moved to Newcastle in the last year, as you say, Paul, they're very welcoming. I watched the game with some Newcastle fans on Friday, and they said, as you said, if Alan St. Maximin left, they'd have absolutely nothing, because Joe Linton cannot hit a barn door. He's got no confidence. If he hits his shot on target, well, actually, he had one on target, but it was well saved by Melier, but a confident striker, nestles at home, Newcastle maybe go on and win, and it's just not clicking for Newcastle. And I've said many times that Mike Ashley doesn't really care, and I just feel that it's going to be a real tough season. And as you said, that there's three worse teams in the Premier League than Burnley, I think Newcastle might be one of those at the moment. To wrap up the show, we need to do Project 114, because Matthew, if you're listening, well, he knows, it's 6-0 for PSG. Just 32 matches left to go, 32 wins, that is, before that cash bonanza goes your way. So fingers crossed for this weekend, although Lionel Messi picked up an injury, I think, so I don't think he's fit for the next one, but do they need him? I know he subbed off at the weekend as they just squeaked past Leon. I know Matthew was very tense about that one. So let's keep it going, Matthew. I need to do the admin now. Paul, thanks for lending us your thoughts this week. Thanks for getting back in the fold. I hope you'd like to join us again sometime soon. And more importantly, do you want to plug your website?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. Yeah, happy to come on anytime you need me. And if you want to see or read more stuff that I've done, then it's www.otbfootball.net.
Fantastic. Carl, do you want to plug your YouTube channel, which you just got off the mark?
Yeah, we're over at Lily White Views on YouTube, Dan. And obviously, you know, we've got our Coy's Spurs channel as well that we're now putting videos out on YouTube for. So get over there. You've got some interesting views and interesting takes on all things Spurs. And I'd say looking forward to coming back next week, though, Dan, and talking more Premier League with you.
Absolutely. Right. Cheers, guys. And also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.